Hey gang, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is August 9th, 2012. And today on the show, something a little bit different. I'm actually going to share with you a segment from the After School Sucks special. The After School Sucks special is the extra content that we produce on the night that we do the live show. We do it from midnight on. Sometimes we've done it until like 2:30 in the morning. But it's not always on target as far as educational content is concerned, and it has more of a relaxed format, so very rarely would any of it end up in the podcast feed. But this week, I'm not going to release the live show that we did. It is up on, will be up on the new website in the AV Club. That's what the bonus content section is called. Now, some of you might be saying, Brett, The Onion has something called the AV Club. It's different, and I thought of it on my own without knowing The Onion had that, so that's what we're going with. It is too good. AV, audio, video, that's what's in the bonus content section. It also implies if you're involved in that, you are a nerd, which we all are. So, it will be the AV Club, and I have been hard at work over the course of the last week, not only uploading and writing show notes, but also categorizing every piece of content that I've ever produced, which is 100 and something, almost 170 podcasts, including archive shows, over 170, 175 podcasts, including archive shows, in addition to shows you've never heard, videos of all our live shows, pre-shows, After School Sucks specials, home movies, a bunch of unreleased live shows that I did with Gardner Goldsmith on Gardner's show, Liberty Conspiracy Live. And this is where Jason and I practiced doing live radio. Dale is in a lot of those, a few other people as well. So all of that stuff will be up on the new website. And believe me, I will keep you posted on any developments with that. I am on the edge of my seat. And I'm really looking forward to getting that done. But in the meantime, I have been sending out videos to people who are on my subscriber list. Last thing I sent out was this after show that I did with Brian Hagan of the Fajita Fun Time, where we talk about Alex Jones for like 90 minutes. And it gets pretty wild. I think David Icke's name is thrown around a few times. But the question that we ask is, Alex Jones, disinformation on purpose or just by accident? Or disinformation at all? Is there value in what Alex Jones does? And, oh, it's an interesting question, because I think there might be, but if you don't have some self-defense, intellectual self-defense, and really emotional self-defense, Alex Jones, InfoWars, that stuff can be a little bit dangerous. So we talk about all that in this after show. And one thing that you should know is that what I decide is the most valuable content as far as its educational value will always be free. It will always go into the podcast feed or onto YouTube, because as a show that has a target audience of people who mostly don't have the means to do transactions online, i.e. a credit card or a PayPal account, I need to make sure that I'm not protecting educational content behind a paywall. So there's a lot of interesting stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's funny. We wanted to fill the hole left by Wheels Off Liberty, which is a comedy show, which is, you know, part of what the whole after show thing is. But there's a lot of serious stuff in there as well. And if you're interested in kind of like a behind-the-scenes look at the podcast, I think the bonus content section will meet your need in that respect as well. So this week, the After School Sucks special had some valuable content, I felt, because Corey and I wound up discussing a listener who wants to do home education. Now, remember, we're not talking about homeschooling, and that's one of the very important things that we discussed in this show, changing our language. Schooling is something that happens in those prison-like concrete buildings that children are forced into for 15,000 hours of their lives, and we don't need to use that word anymore. We want to take that word education back from the schoolers and talk about it with its true definition. So that's what we do today. So a listener email propels us into this discussion, and the whole after show, it will also be available. I put a clip of it up called "SHIT Has Gone Too Far," where I discuss my problems with the word SHIT another thing that I want to talk about, this is really, really just freewheeling here, but another thing that I want to talk about is while I'm sitting here, it's, like I said, August 9th, so I have another live show tonight at 10, and I've been doing show prep for that, but I've also been checking my email, and Richard Grove from Tragedy and Hope sent me a clip of something that is in their premium content section. They have a premium content section for their subscribers, and one of the things they do is called History So It Doesn't Repeat, something I'm really looking forward to. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm also looking forward to being involved in it if I can ever make it back down to Connecticut. But they also have their own more relaxed format show called Tragedy and Hope Casual Cafe. And the one I'm watching right now is called John Taylor Gatto Briefing Number 1, Current Status and Plan of Action. So if you don't know the story, these guys, Richard and Lisa and their team, involved in this episode that I'm watching is Tony Myers, who's been on the show, Cody Hall, who's been on the show, a guy named Kevin Cole, along with Richard and Lisa. And they're talking about their visit to New York to see John Taylor Gatto, who a couple weeks after they filmed The Ultimate History Lesson, a weekend with John Taylor Gatto, he actually suffered, I think, 2 strokes. And he has been in rehabilitation for that for over the last year. So Richard and Cody and Lisa have tried to set up some fundraising efforts. And you might have heard ads on Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock or on Free Talk Live. So I want to do what I can to pitch in. And at the very least, that would be making you aware of it. And if there's, I'm waiting to hear, obviously, from Richard, if anything turns up that I could do, I would probably do it as long as it's, you know, I have the time and the resources to help. Because remember, this show probably wouldn't exist if there was no John Taylor Gatto. And I think we all owe him a lot. His scholarship, his research is absolutely amazing. In addition to The Ultimate History Lesson, another thing that I would recommend is his book, The Underground History of American Education, which I talk about on this show all the time. I have a couple of his other books, Weapons of Mass Instruction and Dumbing Us Down. So, yeah, I mean, I can't say enough about his work and how much it has helped me and how much it has helped this show. So if you do not, here's a way you can help him and you can help yourself. And that would be to go to tragedyandhope.com and get a copy of The Ultimate History Lesson. And I think, or go to ultimatehistorylesson.com, even better. And of course, if you want to try before you buy, I recommend going to Peace Revolution Podcast. Starting at episode 41, they have all of the audio from the interview plus analysis. So it's episodes 41, 42, 43, 44, and 45. That would make sense since it's 5 hours. And what they do is they play the audio from The Ultimate History Lesson and they stop every 15 minutes and then they have a group discussion, which is helpful in processing the information a little bit better because a lot of material is covered and it is a fantastic learning experience. It's something that I think everybody should listen to once or twice. I even thought about reposting the whole thing in my podcast feed. But the good news is that once I have a new website, I can just create, you know, an area for resources and have it all there. So new people can find it by coming to schoolsucksproject.com. But again, that is Peace Revolution Podcast, starting at episode 41. I say start at episode 1. But if you're interested in seeing what The Ultimate History Lesson is all about, go to 41, start there. I think most of you will wind up listening to all 5 of those episodes, which I'm thinking is probably pushing 15 hours of information. And many of you might be saying, Brett, don't you know that Peace Revolution Podcast is one of your toughest and most consistent competitors for the top of the education category on Podomatic.com? I do know that. You know what? Competition is a sin. John D. Rockefeller said that. I'm just kidding. I don't believe that. That's fine. I'm glad we're both up at the top of the education category. Remember, it was one time it was like Sullivan County Department of Education podcast? Oh, I bet that sucks. So anyway, if you hear this before 10 p.m. tonight on August 9th, the Thursday, just so you have all your information straight, 10 p.m. Eastern, we do the live show. We're going to be talking about the systematic extension of childhood and the encouragement from school and society of dependence, and of course ways that young people can work on achieving autonomy. So that's all tonight. Hope you will join our conversation. That's the purpose of doing the live show, is to get more voices into this thing. Thank you very much for listening. Here is a portion of the After School Sucks special from August 2nd, 2012. Bye. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the After School Sucks special for August 2nd, 2012. We have open phones, so we will take your calls, but we wanted to continue in a similar direction to what we were doing in the regular show. And in fact, here's an interesting thing that's never happened before. This might actually become the regular show for this week as far as the podcast is concerned, because we had a multitude of technical difficulties, mostly related to video. In the beginning, they were related to audio. Before the show even started, I had a small fire. The lights up there, this light that's behind me.
Oh, my.
It started to make a sound. And then there was smoke and a burning smell.
And where there's smoke,
there will be fire.
Mmm. That's terrible. However, did you manage to save your life and not burn the whole place down?
Well, these bulbs, these spirally bulbs, yeah. I hear if they break, you have to call like a hazmat team.
Yeah, apparently there's a federal law that says that's the case.
So there's a very good chance that what you're hearing now might not even release what we just did for the last. Well, I mean, I'll put it in I'll put it on the website.
Sure,
and maybe on YouTube. But it might not be the podcast for this week.
Hmm.
So what I wanted to do was I could start by sharing an email that I got from a listener recently. And we're probably going to wind up covering some of the same ground that we already covered. But I thought this was interesting. And I've received a few emails like this in the past. It's from a listener named James, came to me yesterday. I always like to start at the beginning of a podcast series. And I'm up to about number 20 of School Sucks. Thank you so much for articulating this information. It's changing my life. That's always nice to hear.
That is.
I'm passing it on to a few students in government schools that I know. Wow, if the internet had existed when I was a student, I can't imagine how different my life would have been. Growing up in a small town in Oklahoma in the 1970s was a bleak period for information access. It's taken me the rest of my life to discover sources of liberating information like yourself. So successfully, I was brainwashed. I'm writing to ask how to educate young people. I have a daughter who just turned 3. We've planned on homeschooling her all along, but didn't have a clear plan. About a month ago, I found out about the Trivium and have been taking in as much information as I can about that. What I haven't found much information on is what education looks like at earlier stages of development. Do you have children of your own? Can you point me to any books or other resources? I don't have trust in an unknown book I'd find on the shelf at the bookstore. I don't have time or skills to research that material. I am a product of the public schools. I've been lied to and dumbed down. They managed to turn me into an insecure and confused person. I don't have a clear map of reality in my own head. I need to learn along with my daughter, but more information relating to the younger ages would help. Again, thank you for your work. So,
Tricky question to answer. I mean, there's a lot that goes into early child, like what, as they call it, early childhood education, especially around the ages of 2 to 4, is a very important time.
Yeah, but there's a lot of natural processes going on at that time as well.
Right, and those natural processes, as in learning processes, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's... When you see a toddler like playing or like, you know, getting into things, all the stuff that like they train you to stop doing when you go to school, that's not just play. It's not just, you know, messing things up, making a mess for the sake of making a mess. Everything a child does at that age is part of this huge existential research program, really, that they're involved in, learning what it means to be a person.
To answer James' question, as a young child, what does learning look like? It looks a lot like living, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like the natural life and activities of a child.
We don't remember that part of our lives that clearly once we become adults, because, you know, a lot of how we think forms at that time. So it's very difficult to hold on to. We don't remember, but all that playing that kids do, and we think, oh, the kids are silly, they just play all the time. There's a very important reason for that.
Yeah. You know, that exploratory process that I think would be habit forming if at the age of six things weren't drastically changed.
Yeah.
And very unnatural things start to happen. So, you know, I don't think that people need to be overly concerned with what education should look like
right
at that age, because it's happening, because it's natural, because your child is living, your child is exploring, your child's natural gifts are completely unaffected by mm-hmm. any sort of outside influence or unnatural forces. So it's happening. You know, I think this goes into what we were talking about before as well, that the language needs to change and the mindset needs to change. Schooling puts us in a box, and I'm not talking about all the ways we normally talk about on this show, like giving us a safe range of outcomes that are desirable for people who might like to control us.
Right.
Those boxes are all there as well. But our experience and how just pervasive the schooling is in our culture, in our society, in our political thinking as adults, in our interface or how we interact with society, there's a box there as well, because specifically with how we think and talk about learning and education,
mm-hmm.
it's all done with this terminology that we learned through the schooling process.
Right.
And that's something that I think is very important for us to let go of completely. We talked about all of these words, right? Level, grade, what else? Teaching.
Teaching
was the big one. Because parents will ask, how do I teach my child?
Right. How do I teach my kid, rather than how do I let my kid learn?
Right. How do I get out of the way? You know? So I think that James's email is very thoughtful here.
Mm-hmm.
And if a few clicks of a mouse or a few flips of pages through a book happened for many, many other parents, they would find themselves having the same questions.
Right.
And the same dilemma, and maybe some of the same anxiety that he feels about having a three-year-old daughter.
Right.
Like, I can't send her to school, but I don't know what to do. And he was very forthright that, hey, I'm a product of these schools. I don't have a clear map of reality. I'm confused about where to go. And I think that even though that's sad, and of course we've all been there, I think, or most of us have been there, most of us know how that feels, or we can remember how that feels, the acknowledgement of that is very important, and the willingness to learn along with a child, I think, is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is really no formula. Like, right. I don't think people can be helpful guides, and people can say, I did this and it worked for my child when we lived here,
right.
And he or she was this many years old. But schooling is about formulas for teaching
right.
the same thing to everybody. Natural education, home education, I don't even want to call it homeschooling, unschooling. We can get away from the schooling word, the you
right.
are doing something to your child kind of language.
The whole idea that there is a formula that'll work for everybody is a trick that they've pulled on us. The government schooling has led us to assume that there is a way, a right way to do it. You know, because they'll tell you theirs is the right way, and you may be smart enough, you know, you may be observant enough to figure out that their way isn't the right way, and then you go start looking what the right way is.
Sure.
You know, but there won't be a right way that's right for everybody, of course.
This is also,
it seems obvious when I say it like that, but most people don't ever consider it.
Yeah. And you can see how quickly that we can get trapped by this kind of thinking, too, in all of our conversations that come from the philosophy of liberty and are applicable to defense or mm-hmm. economics or education, where people want us to talk in the box like the politicians
right.
talk to them. What's the solution? Give me a plan. Where are the answers?
Right.
And it's okay to have some humility and say, I don't know.
Right.
I've never even met everybody's child, so how would I know what would be good for them?
It's kind of like if you took one of B.F. Skinner's rats out of his box that has the food pellet button in it and then you released him into the wild.
Yeah.
Like, he wouldn't know how to take care of himself. He would just always be looking around going, well, where's my food button? And I think that's what we end up, how we end up feeling, you know, when we, if you take your child out of school, you're going to be looking to replace it with something similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because that's our tendency.
And what's unfortunate is that this child, this three-year-old, and a lot of people are in the same situation that James finds himself in, mm-hmm. this child has never even been to school.
Right.
Right. From their point of view, they don't have to worry about that imagery that I used so many times earlier in the show today of the teacher within, the curiosity being choked and poisoned by the system.
Right.
That's never happened to them. There's nothing for them to recover from. But what's sad, but I also think is very important to point out, is that the parents of that child have been through that, and
right.
it has shaped their attitudes and their outlook about what education should be. And if there is this absence, if there's this vacuum where school is for everybody else, what do we fill it with?
Right.
You know? So I think, James, you're doing all the right things, and I think you're asking all the right questions. But you need to also really be as aware as possible. And it sounds like from what I read that you're being pretty honest with yourself about this, that you need to distance and detach yourself from everything, from all of your associations and all of your conceptions of what schooling should be. Schooling and learning are opposites. Learning and living are synonymous.
Right.
So people talk about learning so often as if it's like something separate
right.
from life.
Yes.
Like, oh, I go to this place from 8 to 3.
And I learn, and then I stop learning and do my thing.
Until I have to do homework at 5, which is more learning.
Right.
But then, like, when I'm not learning, I do stuff I like, which is weird because
yeah.
that's when the best learning takes place.
Right, because you're engaged and you're interested in the subject matter and you're pursuing it for your own edification.
Yeah. Terminology is very important. I said that I have watched an 8-year-old boy learn as much in 10 minutes. A willing, curious, and confident child learn in 10 minutes as much as I could teach a group of 16 and 17-year-old high school students in a week, right? Because teaching is this imposition.
Right.
And learning is not. So we were supposed to have Lorette Lynn on the show tonight, and this is one of the most valuable things that I've learned from her, is that you are not going to do something to your child, right?
Right.
Like everything that we've learned, I think, pretty much in our adult lives, and you have less college than me, so you had like more of a head start on this too, probably, in your own life, where I was stuck in that place having my opinions formed for me without
right.
much critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And like this is where it first occurred to me that I might actually be smart. But when my history teacher, who was this progressive but very challenging in the way he taught and what he expected out of students,
mm-hmm.
when he said or communicated to me through a variety of ways that I had promise, that I had potential, that I had intelligence, that he was impressed with what I was doing in his class, I'm kind of thinking it had a lot to do with how well I repeated his views back to him. So James also mentions, and Corey, I don't know how familiar you are with this, because I don't know if we've talked about it on the show when you've been on before, the trivium.
Sorry, no.
It goes way back. Some people are somewhat critical of the terminology because it has some religious tie-ins, but it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with religion.
Okay.
As far as its practical application is concerned. The trivium is a three-step process. Trivium, where three roads meet, pretty much,
okay.
Is what it means. And it deals with the three components of critical thinking for autodidacts, and this can also be correlated with classical education or the tools of self-teaching. Kind of a shorthand. So the three parts of the trivium, the first one is grammar. Understanding the actual nuts and bolts language of a certain subject area. What do words mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the logic. How do these words work together? And then the rhetoric. How do you take the grammar that you've learned, the logic that integrates that grammar, and communicate it to other people effectively? in a nutshell, this is a subject where there can be a tremendous amount of scholarship. And Jan Ervin, who does the Gnostic Media podcast, a whole website. I think it's just trivium.com. There was a band called Trivium, too. Just a quick insert. It is actually triviumeducation.com. TRIVIUM education.com. All right, back to the show. So he might not have gotten away with trivium.com.
Yeah.
But I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And, of course, tragedyandhope.com is a great resource for this stuff as well. But I brought that up because I think it relates to our conversation very well. This language is something that needs a closer evaluation, a reevaluation, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're talking about education, we really have to cleanse that word of all our preconceived notions that were formed in school.
Right.
Right. So if the grammar is out of place, you know, our logic can be fine and the way we communicate or share ideas can be fine, but it can still be disastrous in the end. So, for example, if we agree on the logic of ginger ale is good for an upset stomach,
mm-hmm.
and we communicate that idea effectively to people, it seems like everything would go well. But if we go back to the grammar of that and we find that we've all decided to call a handful of thumbtacks ginger ale,
right.
That's not good for an upset stomach and the rest of the process, and you know, that does not have a good outcome.
Right.
So is the case with school.
Okay.
Right? Schooling and education, right? Schooling is not ginger ale. It's a handful of thumbtacks.
Right.
You know, okay. Your mind is an upset stomach. So, oh, man. James, I think you're still obviously holding on to some of those ideas, but I really think that you're on the right track as far as realizing that and trying to really purge your thinking of all of those associations that come from school. This was actually something that I wanted to share earlier, but we didn't get a chance. It's from a website called Zero to Three, which has to do with early childhood and parenting. And the title of this is Tips on Nurturing Your Child's Curiosity. Babies are born learners with a natural curiosity to figure out how the world works. Curiosity is the desire to learn. It is an eagerness to explore, discover, and figure things out. The more curious a child is, the more he learns. Nurturing your child's curiosity is one of the most important ways you can help her become a lifelong learner. Parents and caregivers don't have to make their children curious or push their children to learn. In fact, research shows that it is a child's internal desire to learn, their curiosity, not external pressure, that motivates him to seek out new experiences and lead to greater success in school over the long term. And obviously, the author of this article might be coming from a totally different point of view than we are with respect to school, but I think that that's a valid point. Curiosity doesn't really work in school.
No. You get shot down.
Right.
Curious.
Yeah. You can certainly land yourself in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lip service paid to everything in school. So it's not explicit that curiosity is frowned upon.
Right.
But one time I remember curiosity not being popular at all was college.
Mm.
Right. And that's the curiosity. If it's like, are there other explanations besides the one that you're putting forward?
Right.
Mr. or Mrs. Professor. And I don't want to apply this across the board. I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. But I think there are certainly college professors who like that environment because they have a very captive audience of very spongy, uncritical minds, the products of the public school.
Right.
Where they can have their house of cards belief system parroted back to them, you know, in this echo chamber. And, you know, for a self-important kind of person, that's a really nice place to be.
I mean, the people I've met who are actually professionally in academia at the college level as a professor, you know, I've never met one of them who didn't think that, you know, the way he saw everything was exactly how it was. And if the only way that you can get him to even acknowledge that another point of view exists is to get him to argue against it.
Sure.
And all of the work and all the research they do is all just finding ways to shore up, you know, their views on the world. And instead of going, is there another way?
Yeah.
They set out to find evidence that supports what they already believe.
And there's, confirmation bias. That was actually what I was talking about in my segment by myself when I started the show today. And there's different levels of humility that go with that. I mean, some of them may acknowledge that they have one side of two. Some may not. And I know this from experience because when I was a young teacher, I took the views that were basically inflicted upon me about history and government and politics and economics.
Mm-hmm.
And early in my career, inflicted them on other people. And I talked a little bit during our show about some of the strategies that I was using to encourage this synthetic curiosity in high school students. Have a hook, you know, have something that gets them interesting. Present a conflict. Introduce the ideas that there are multiple ways to think about something.
Right.
So the example I gave was like, how did we get here? All these different theories of creation and evolution and de-evolution and genetic engineering by aliens and all this. But I knew in the end, I was steering them back towards evolution.
Right.
And I had to be judicious about the information that I presented and careful about how I made sure it wound up back where I needed it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But this applied pretty much to everything I did. This was my mistake. Like, yes, let's have a conversation about all of your different ideas. When you're done talking, I'll tell you how it is.
Mm.
Which is pointless, which is kind of a pointless exercise. And I think if you're not careful about how you do it, you can lead to people feeling dumb. And ultimately less confident in their decision making skills, their opinions, the validity of their opinions, because you say, oh, well, thank you for filling up some time with your adorable ideas.
Right.
But this is, you know, this is the way things really were.
Right.
Are, so on and so forth. Okay, just to interject again, a very important point of clarification here. There was something that I glossed over, and this is just the product of doing the show live on the fly and not taking the time to properly organize my thoughts on this one specific point anyway. When I say this was my mistake, that should have been explicated a little bit better. What I mean is that these students should have received tools to come to objective knowledge and correct conclusions based on evidence. I am not suggesting, even though I think it kind of sounded like that, maybe a little bit, that they could make up their own meaning and all their opinions were equal in value regardless of what they were based on. I think I've talked about that enough in the past that you know I don't believe that. That's silliness. It's kind of like the silliness that we were talking about in the last show about No Child Left Behind. So that needed to be inserted right there. I hope that goes without saying for people who've been listening to the show, but if you're new, I wanted to clarify. Thanks. Here's that show that you were listening to.
The author goes on here and says, curiosity is something that babies are born with. They come into the world with a drive to understand how the world works. A newborn follows sounds, faces, interesting objects with their eyes. An eight-month-old shakes their rattle and puts it in their mouth to see what the object can do. Let's jump to something that's more helpful to James. A two-year-old pretends she is the garbage collector and puts all of her stuffed animals into the laundry basket, garbage truck, to figure out what it feels like to be in the other person's shoes. Below, you'll find a series of tips for ways you can nurture, not force or make your child curious, but nurture them, support the curiosity that's already there, model interest in the world around you. This is something that I think people should try to do at all ages. If they are some kind of educator or facilitator of an educational experience, that's very important.
And the truth is, we spend more time kind of suppressing that natural curiosity. When children go through that phase where they ask you why, they're just constantly asking why. And then you tell, why is the sky blue? And you could tell them, but there's always going to be a fact in there that we assume. But the kids will always go, why?
Right.
Why are you going to bed? Because I'm tired. Why? Because I worked all day. Why? Because I need money. And they'll keep going forever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know, because they literally know nothing about the world. These things that we assume are true that are just accepted as facts, they have no knowledge of that.
And, I mean, I think that adults still have this. There is nothing more frustrating than a mystery in an area
where you're very interested or engaged or have some kind of emotional involvement. Like, there can't be unknowns in certain things. There are. There's the problem of the absence of knowledge that needs to be solved.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, this might only manifest in negative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes people in relationships get to be very nosy, you know?
Yes.
And especially in today's age of information. This is something that actually happens a lot. And I've, you know, talked to friends of mine who are girls and friends of mine who are guys, and I think this has even happened to me in the past. People will go through another person's stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Through their email, you know?
Whitney Houston had a whole song about it.
Really?
Yeah. And then she had a song called It's Not Right, But It's Okay, ostensibly about her boyfriend cheating on her. But the song was really about her snooping on him. Who's calling you from this area code? Who's this? You know?
Now, that's probably one of the worst ways. That desire to close those gaps, to fill in those blanks in information, can manifest for a person. But I think it speaks to that very natural and what can be a very healthy drive to
find out more.
Find out more about something that you're interested in.
Right.
Like, sometimes you just can't be stopped. Unless somebody could put you in an environment where they ultimately make you interested in nothing.
Yes. They convince you that history is boring, that math is boring.
Yeah, exactly. So the second piece of advice I also agree with very much, follow your child's lead. If you're an adult and you've been through something like 16 or 18 years of institutionalized schooling, your 3 or 4 year old child has a better built-in teacher than you do, in my opinion. The author writes, encourage natural interest. Children learn so much more through activities that capture their attention and imagination. If he likes music, play it for him often. Make him play instrumentals together, dance together. If bugs are her thing, give her a shovel and a net. Find books on bugs and read to her. A couple more that are helpful here. And James, I hope you find some of this information useful. Answer questions simply and clearly according to your child's development. So I think this is what you were just speaking to, Corey, with all the
yes.
why questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also okay to say that you don't know.
Yeah.
Right? Louis C.K. has a funny bit where he he takes the why questions all the way to the point where he has to admit to his daughter that he's stupid because he didn't pay attention in school and smoked too much pot. And his parents were stupid and were bad people. So your child should know, in my opinion anyway, you're a learner too.
Right.
This is something that goes on forever.
Yeah.
Stimulate your child with open-ended questions. This was something that I tried to do when I was a teacher. But again, even this article, which I don't think is too bad, and I don't want to say is unenlightened, it still kind of has, it's still in the paradigm of
top-down
the
teaching.
Top-down. Not too much. It's not that bad. It's not saying, you know, do this specific thing, set this specific routine. And I think that we might be in a place where this is actually necessary because
yeah.
this is how people think about their relationship with their children. So they can't just get, oh, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Let them go. They're better at it than you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's, I think, for people who are so schooled in a society that is so schooled, that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Create an interesting environment. That is something that I think is a parent's job. And certainly there are situations where parents have to intervene for safety reasons. There are times some redirection is needed
right.
for safety reasons. But that has a lot to do with being proactive and setting up the right environment to keep a child safe. And I think that could also apply to keeping a child interested and engaged, because a child who is 3 or 4 years old will not bring a list to a parent
right.
and say, these are the things that I need to feed my curiosity.
Right.
Right. So the parent, as an observer, can watch that happen and then respond and create that environment for them. So being proactive yeah. is very important.
I don't know. I honestly, my gut, I haven't done as much research on this, obviously, as the person who wrote this article or as you. But my feeling is that people worry so much about what do I do to get my child interested in learning, especially at that young age. I mean, what do I do to get my toddler interested in learning? I think that's not something you really need to worry about, because look at how much trouble government school has to go through to get them to stop being curious, to get them to stop wanting to learn.
Oh, yeah.
It takes a lot of time and effort. It takes years to accomplish.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, they've got it down to a science, but it does still take years. I mean, so the trick is, you know, I don't think getting and keeping your children interested in learning is really the problem. You know, it's knowing, you know, what to do with yourself, because you always assumed at some point that I'll watch the kid for a couple of years, help him figure out some of the basics of life, and then I'll let somebody else teach them.
It takes us back to the trivium, too. Like a child's desire to do step one, to learn language, to make meaning, is very natural.
Right.
A child's desire to form concepts, to get rid of contradictions,
right,
is natural. A child's desire to communicate effectively and clearly and in a meaningful and beneficial way with other people is natural, right? But people can be polite.
Mm-hmm.
People can be, they can say thank you. They can hold a door for you. They can behave well at work. But people seem to have, from my experience anyway, and it's something that I find very frustrating in different aspects of my social life, is people are afraid of communicating anything meaningful.
Oh, yes.
To each other.
That's true.
And yeah, all of that other stuff is natural, meaning that it's instantaneous. Going back to what you were saying about how much work school has to do.
Yeah.
That takes 15,000 hours.
Right.
You know, you're not there because you got 15,000 hours worth of information. I mean, there's a variety of reasons why people are in school that long. A lot of it has to do with political reasons and union control,
right,
of the school system. Lots of places have made kindergarten part of the mandatory public education. There's lots of places that are talking about making preschool. You know, wow. I mean, they want state-run education from birth.
Jeez.
So that's something that's been in the work. But kindergarten has been consumed by the 1 through 12 public education now in many states.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's so commonly part of, like, in, you know, K through 12 rather than 1 through 12. I didn't even know there were places where it wasn't part of the whole mandatory 12 years.
Sure. It never was in New Hampshire. Like, my kindergarten when I was in school was private.
Hmm.
So there's just a couple more here that I wanted to go over. Next one says, redirect, don't discourage. Try to figure out what is capturing her interest or what she is trying to master and create a safe and acceptable way for her to explore. For young children, I think this is very important. You know, like, parents do need to be involved,
right,
for safety's sake. For example, if your toddler is exploring the houseplants, pull them out, put them out of reach, but offer a close alternative. Put some dirt in a plastic container for your child to play with and inspect. If she likes to pour water from her cup onto the high chair or the floor, move her to the kitchen floor, bathtub, or backyard after a meal so she can explore and experiment with water without driving you crazy.
Hmm.
This will also teach children problem-solving skills, creative and acceptable ways to do and get what they want. No, I don't have much of a problem with that. No. I mean, you know, if you're in charge of one thing as the parent, it certainly is the environment.
Right.
The last one is allow time for open-ended activities. Unlike some toys that are designed to be used in a certain way, materials like boxes, blocks, water, sand, pots and pans, and any art material can be used imaginatively. Do not tell your child what to do with the material or how to do it or what it should look like in the end. Let your child's curiosity be her guide.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I really like that one. You know, I think that's great.
Because, I mean, the thing is, although I think it's selling the imagination of a small child somewhat short. Because if you think that they can only take something like a box or a pot or a pan and use, or art supplies and use them imaginatively. Like children do everything imaginatively. Even if a toy is meant to be played with a certain way, they're going to find new ways to play with it because they don't have a lifetime of experience. Like we were projecting our lifetime of experience onto them, so that because we know there are certain ways that things get done, right? So we project onto them that, well, if we give them a toy that is supposed to be played with a certain way, then they're going to play with it a certain way. It's going to stunt their imagination. That's not what kids are like at all, though. They don't really do anything the way it's supposed to be done. That's all they have is their imagination to figure out how things get done.
I wonder how many toys and games were invented through what you're just describing. Like, oh, that's, I never would have thought of doing that.
Yeah,
that.
Just watching toddlers.
Yeah.
Going, hey,
yeah.
Whoa.
There's cultural and societal and marketing, advertising pressures on this as well, but toys have very specific purposes.
But nowadays, toys sell, you know. Toys are there to be sold or to sell you on a TV show or vice versa.
Sure. Oh, and the whole thing that the author was talking about, when you're done, put this together and it will look like this.
Right.
Follow these instructions. And that's a different skill, maybe for a different time. Like, here's how to build something using a plan.
Right.
It's not bad.
No.
But it's nurturing and fostering and maybe building different skills than curiosity. So even with something that has... like a specific purpose. Like, I remember when I was a kid, matchbox cars were huge, but little kids still find exciting. And I've seen like 2 and 3 year olds do wild things with matchbox cars and dinosaurs.
Sure. You know,
there are no rules.
No.
Yeah. I think that's really good advice. Cause when kids are, get older, and certainly adults, when they want to have fun, it's never like, let's get some boxes. Let's get some boxes, a couple gallons of water, see where it goes.
Yeah. Let's see what water does when you pour it out of a cup. You know, we're there. We know what water does when you pour it out of a cup, but a two-year-old doesn't know that.
But I mean, even an adult version of that kind of thinking is so rare. When
right.
a group of friends get together and they say, I mean, we do it, but to say, let's play Scrabble.
Right.
But no one ever says, let's make up a game.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which might be a wild time and a lot of fun.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Did we just invent let's make up a game night?
I think we might have. I mean, you know, the whole with due respect to the person who invented the concept of let's make up a game. Right. We're having let's make up a game night where it's a regular thing.
Sure. Yeah.
We can just get like a bunch of like random parts, like dice. And like little, you know, counters from board games, and then make something out of it.
We could get a fishbowl. Here I am making up the rules already.
All right.
We could get a fishbowl and just put all different components of all different kinds of games on little pieces of paper and put them in the fishbowl. And so every different time you pick 10 or 15 of them. And
then we'd have to figure out how to put like Monopoly and Connect Four together and make a game out of it.
Holy shit.
I know, right? You know what? Actually, there is one area where adult people tend to be creative and make up their own games, and that's drinking games.
Mm.
That's the one time they don't seem to be shy about making up, like, you know, play and games as adults is drinking games.
Adults are also creative in other ways as well, and they can be very, they can really put their imagination to use, thinking of things to worry about.
Yeah.
Thinking of things to be afraid of. Coming up with rationalizations for why things need to be the way they are.
Right.
Why the status quo is good. You know, unfortunately, all of that is a waste, though.
Yeah.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and tell a fact about where they live.
Okay, everybody. Well, I'm running... hold on a second. And okay, so I'm running a little bit behind on this, and a lot of catch-up I got to do. If, for any reason, you are a new subscriber and you are left out, please email me immediately at brett@edgeolution.com or find me on Facebook, and I will certainly correct that oversight. So, first new subscriber. These aren't even new anymore. Some of these are so long ago. I'm sorry I fell behind on this. It's Tony. He lives in York, Pennsylvania. Now, you know York, Pennsylvania, very historic place. It's been in the middle of all of the wars that have been fought in the United States, revolutionary, some stuff during the Civil War. But what's interesting about York, what I bet you don't know, is that in the late 1770s, there's a plot that originated at a tavern in York, Pennsylvania, called the Conway Cabal. And this describes a series of events and meetings and suggestions and maybe even some planning. And the idea was maybe George Washington should be replaced as the commander of the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. Imagine if that had happened. Because Washington wasn't that good at killing at first. It wasn't until the end of the war that he really picked it up, surprising people on Christmas. There would be no famous George Washington, or a far less famous George Washington. Maybe the colonies wouldn't have even won the Revolutionary War. Could you imagine the United States today under British rule? Taxation without representation and whatnot. Next, we have Samantha, and she is in West Dundee, Illinois. Well, what can I tell you about West Dundee, Illinois? That's what I say while I get my notes ready about West Dundee. If you're ever there, I highly recommend visiting the Chester Gould Dick Tracy Museum. Thanks, Samantha. Moving on, we have Jonathan, who's in Grove City, Ohio. And a lot of notable professional athletes currently reside in Grove City. We have Gary Burley, former professional football player, played for the Bengals. He was in Super Bowl 16. That was a while ago. Derek Combs, Mr. Football Ohio in 1996, went on to play in the pros. Ann Grossman, professional tennis player. And, of course, Josh Harris, the quarterback at Bowling Green, and then he went on to play in some non-NFL league, the UIFL. I think that's international. And that place, there just must be tennis balls and footballs bouncing around all over the place, huh? We have another Jonathan in Carmichael, California. Carmichael, if you're ever there, I highly recommend a couple of attractions. First, you have the Chautauqua Playhouse, little 95-seat theater, beautiful, quaint. They have comedies, dramas, musicals. There's a little children's theater on the weekends there. And the Jensen Botanical Gardens. Wide variety of flowers, including camellias. Very rare flower. Then we have James, who lives in Mentor, Ohio. Now, you say, that's an interesting name for a place. Mentor, Ohio. What's it named after? Well, it actually comes from Greek mythology. Now, without getting into too much detail, this actually comes from the story of Odysseus. The word, actually, I should say, mentor, comes from the name of this character. See, when Odysseus went to fight in the Trojan War, he left Mentor in charge of his son Telemachus. So it becomes the term because of his relationship with this boy, meeting somebody who imparts wisdom and shares knowledge with a less experienced colleague. The first recorded usage of the term goes all the way back to the end of the 1600s in a book called Les Aventures de Télémaque by the French writer François Fénon. Maybe I'm overcompensating on my pronunciation a little bit. Anyway, thanks, James. Hope things are going well out in Mentor. From Ohio, we travel to Traverse City, Michigan, where we have Paul, another new subscriber. Traverse City, Michigan. Well, Traverse City, Michigan is actually home of the National Cherry Festival. We missed it this year, everybody, but it is the first week of July. Every year, there's parades, fireworks, an air show at this cherry festival, a pie-eating contest, and of course, cherries. So if you're ever in Traverse City in July, during the first week of the month, check out the National Cherry Festival, and thank you, Paul, for subscribing. Then we have Donald. I feel like I might have done a couple of these before, but I'm not sure. Donald is in North Glen, Colorado. And folks, I just learned from the town's website this morning that the recycling center is now accepting leaves and branches. So that's very helpful if you live there. I'm sure it's beautiful, but didn't really find out too much about old North Glen. But thank you very much, Donald. Then we go out to Washington, Bothell, Washington, where we have Earl in the town that produced the largest Christmas tree, I believe, in world history. In 1962, Life magazine recognized their 112-footer as the largest living Christmas tree in the world. But in the late 1970s, the tree died. Thanks, Earl. And that's it for the United States. Please, if I'm looking at a couple names here that I felt like I already did. Michael in Forest Park, Illinois. Sky in Seattle, Washington. Joe in Palmyra, New York. I know we did him because that's the birthplace of the Church of Latter-day Saints. But those were three on my list. I think I covered them last time. And we have two from outside of the country. First, we have Daniel, and he lives in Kitchener. That's in Ontario, Canada. There's some disagreement on this, but some say that Kitchener is the birthplace of recycling. It was in 1981 that they pioneered the blue box program. We've all seen, you know, the blue boxes that you put everything in to be recycled. That started in Kitchener. And finally, we have Angela, who lives in Fairy Grove, which is in Queensland, Australia. Now, a lot of people send me emails saying, Brett, I want to subscribe, but I'm worried that I live too far away. Well, Angela shows us what is possible. You cannot get much further away from me than that. So what about Fairy Grove? Now, Fairy Grove is just a suburb, mostly residential. So let me talk to you a little bit about Queensland. Of all the places that we have covered today on new subscriber geography trivia, it is fair to say that Queensland was the first to be settled. It is estimated that Indigenous Australians and Torres Strait Islanders arrived in this part of Australia, which is the northeast corner. It's basically the northeast. You could almost say it's the northeast quadrant, a little less than a quadrant, 40,000 years ago. William Janszoon was the first European to show up there. That was in 1607. Big time for exploring. People were showing up around that time in the quote-unquote New World as well. Roanoke, Virginia. You ever heard that story? Story for another time. Wait till we get a subscriber from Roanoke. Do you live in Roanoke? SchoolSucksProject.com/support. I will tell you that story.
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.